So tonight I'm going to start out by talking a little bit about, I guess I would call literature, the arts, their power to expose the human condition. And I'll start by just mentioning that last night my wife and I went to a movie in town called Blue Jasmine. And I'm not going to say much about the movie, except to say that it's excellent. I highly recommend it. It's a Woody Allen movie. In his inimitable way, he is able to expose the human condition, show its tragic side and its comedic side, often at the same time. So it's very wonderful how he's able to do that. But before the movie, you know how there are these trailers. They'll show you movies coming up, and they're often way more exciting than the movie itself when you finally see it, and all the best parts have already been spoiled. But one of the trailers, it was the one just before Blue Jasmine started, was on a new documentary. And the name of this, and for me it was somewhat synchronistic, the name of it is Salinger. And it's a new unauthorized documentary on the life of J.D. Salinger, who most of you, I'm sure, have heard of. He's a famous American writer. And one of the things in this very dramatic trailer, I don't know how you can make someone's biography as dramatic as they did, but they quoted him saying the following. He said, And this is an incomplete and imperfect quote, but he said something along the lines of, "The only way that anyone would undertake such a traumatizing, difficult task as writing a novel is if they're driven by some deep inner demon." It was something like that. And I got it. And I got it because I had just read a couple of things by J.D. Salinger, and this is why it was somewhat synchronistic. A couple of months ago, I was looking in the bookcase and I saw this old paperback, dog-eared paperback, that I had never myself read, and it was Franny and Zooey. And I pulled it down from the bookcase. I had made a promise to myself several months ago that I'd try to read more classic literature, because much of that I kind of skipped over, both when I was a teenager, because I was so hyper-scientific at that time and I just thought it was a waste of time. And then later in life, because as a Zen student, I didn't want to distract myself with a lot of reading. So there was a lot of literature that I missed that I think can be very, very helpful, especially for a Zen student. The first of the two stories in Franny and Zooey is called Franny. And rather than try to tell you what I remember about reading it, I actually looked it up on Wikipedia, and there was a beautiful terse description, which I'll read to you now, and you'll understand a little bit about where J.D. Salinger was coming from. He recently died, by the way. So this is just a little two paragraphs on the book, the first of these two books called Franny and Zooey. It's actually a short story. And it goes like this. This section of the two books, Franny, concerns Franny's weekend date with her collegiate boyfriend, Lane Coutel. He takes her to a fashionable lunchroom where he's described as, quote, monopolizing the conversation and trying to impress Franny with his news of receiving a suggestion to publish his latest paper on Flaubert, who is a French writer. Franny appears upset, questioning the importance of college education and the worth of Lane's friends. She eats nothing, feels faint, and becomes progressively more uncomfortable talking to Lane. Eventually, she excuses herself to visit the restroom where, after a crying spell, she regains her composure. She returns to the table where Lane questions her on the small book she's been carrying. She responds nonchalantly, that the book is titled The Way of a Pilgrim and tells the story of how a Russian wanderer learns the power of, quote, praying without ceasing. The Jesus prayer involves internalizing the prayer, quote, Lord Jesus Christ, Son of God, have mercy on me, a sinner, end of quote. To a point where, in a manner similar to a Zen koan, it becomes unconscious, almost like a heartbeat. So this is this praying without ceasing. Lane is less interested in the story than in keeping their timetable for the party and a football game, though when Franny faints, he tends to her and postpones the weekend's activities. After she wakes, he goes to get a taxi and leaves Franny alone, practicing the act of praying without ceasing. That's basically the story. So, a little while ago, I vaguely remember reading another J.D. Salinger book, and the title of that was Catcher in the Rye. And I presume that most of the people in this room have read it, because it's almost required reading for every high school student, even though it sometimes early after the book was published, actually the year I was born in 1951, was written in the 40s. And just as an interesting side story, four of the chapters that he wrote were while he was a soldier in World War II, and I guess he carried them in his pocket during D-Day, and they somehow survived. It was just an interesting side story. So the book was written in the mid-40s and then finally published in 1951, and it was really groundbreaking, shocking. It exposed something in a very raw way. And it was at a time when people weren't looking in this direction. Right after the war, in the 50s, we all, you know, people in my generation remember the 50s as a kind of hazy, fluffy, backlit golden age where everything was perfect. We would say the Pledge of Allegiance, and there would be a picture of Dwight Eisenhower, the president, on the wall, and everything seemed safe. You could walk to school and no one would kidnap you, et cetera, et cetera. And mom always was at home cooking, and dad was out working. And it was a stultifying, very sort of regimented time. People knew their role, and people didn't really question their role very deeply, and out comes this book, Catcher in the Rye. So Catcher in the Rye, I started reading it, and I realized after a chapter or two that I'd actually never read it. I had read the Cliff Notes, and I didn't realize till I had gotten into the book somewhat that I had profoundly cheated myself as a teenager. That this book was written for me, as it was for many people who read it. And reading it now, I so totally related to this protagonist in the story, the main character. This young man is about 17 years old. His name was Holden Caulfield. And he was very alienated. And he saw himself falling into a world made up of what he called goddamn phonies. And actually the word phony appears in the book 30 times. I read that tonight too in Wikipedia. But basically he saw the world surrounding him as made up of people playing the role of themselves and never really showing their honest side, never truly being intimate. And this discomfited him severely. He suffered greatly from this. He felt deeply alienated. And at the same time, he himself was a phony. He somehow couldn't escape the phoniness. It was his only protection from connecting with this deeply pained, very alienated, lonely, hurting part of himself. The only way to protect himself that he knew at that time was to be phony himself, was to hide behind a veneer of a self. to go through the motions, to, as someone once when I was very young told me, to play the game, with quotes around it. He learned to play the game. And this book goes deeply into this, what we could call the human condition, which one might say is being trapped in an entity with characteristics that you feel you are identified with, trapped in. And this identity with characteristics that you might call your small self is trapped in a world outside it that it can't control, that it views as dangerous, that it also views as pushing it ever more and more towards inauthenticity. And this is really the theme of this book. And it was just so beautifully put. I can't say it was beautifully written, but what he wrote about and the depth within which he went and the times during which he wrote it and its great relevance right now. I mean, he could be describing the millennium generation, Generation X, the hippies, everything, every young person. It's really a wonderful story of what happens to human beings as we create this map, as we enter a world that is very inauthentic in so many ways, surrounded by the advertising of how we ought to be and how the perfect person is, and feeling as young adults as we leave childhood that we are not perfect, that we need to become perfect in some way. And then we join Facebook, and we have a virtual self, and we try to make that self as perfect as possible. And all the time we're doing it, we're feeling more and more depressed, more and more alienated. There's a recent study that looked at people on Facebook, and the longer they spent on it, the more unhappy they became. And this really is this Holden Caulfield. Now, what was the meaning of Catcher in the Rye? Well, he remembered wrongly, it happens to be, and it's mentioned in the book, a line from a poem by Robert Burns. And the poem by Robert Burns was actually just Robert Burns writing down a very old folk song in Scotland. And the lines of it that are relevant to what we're talking about go like this. If a body meet a body, coming through the rye. And the actual poem is a very body tale with sexual innuendos about two people encountering themselves in the rye and being hidden and then meeting themselves in a sexual way. But in the book, he remembered it as when a body meet a body, when a body catch a body coming through the rye. Catch a body. He saw it differently. It was part of his immaturity that he couldn't perhaps remember it in the way that the poem was written, in the way that it was intended to be understood, but he saw it in a different way, in some ways a much more profound way, yet a troubled way. So this Catcher in the Rye, he then explained to his sister Phoebe later how he remembered this poem, that he wanted, his deepest desire, was to be a catcher in the rye. And he had this image of young children playing in a rye field. And at the edge of the field was a cliff. And he would stand near the cliff and catch them before they fell off of it. What a powerful image of coming from this place of innocence, kind of our original true self, playing. Being in the sunshine, running through a rye field, and a cliff is waiting, and we could fall off that cliff and become adults, grown-ups. And his role, his deepest desire, was to be this catcher in the rye. Sometimes I think of, now having read this, what we are here, all of us here are catchers in the Zendo. We're catching ourselves from falling off this cliff of false identification, of thinking, of map-making, bringing ourselves back up this cliff, back to this rye field in the sunshine, in the moment, spontaneous, fully involved, no dividing lines. So it's a very, very profound image in a book that exposes in such a wonderful way, and this is the power of literature, this aspect of the human condition, being feeling trapped in an entity, a self with characteristics, and that self with characteristics being trapped in a world outside it. So Holden Caulfield in this book seeks the advice of others, or is given unbidden the advice of others, most of them grown-ups. And some of them are very nice people, they're really kindly, they genuinely want him to be happy. But not a single one knows how to get him to that place, because they've all fallen off the cliff. None of them really knows, none of them can really do it for him. And I'm thinking as I'm reading this book, if only he could have encountered Zen at this time, it would be the one thing that would save him from this fate in a world of people living virtual lives, living within maps, drawing dividing lines, having and holding to ideas of perfection and imperfection, of right and wrong, of good and bad, of what you should be doing and what you shouldn't be doing, and the ways in which it was crushing him, hurting him. Certain things that he would hear, songs or movies, would make him feel depressed. And he had just a beautiful description of this, what he called phoniness. He was unable to go to a play or a movie, although he did go to one in the book and hated it, because the actors were either obviously acting, or they were such good actors that they would play the role almost so perfectly you couldn't tell they're playing a role, but you could tell that they were proud of themselves being such good actors. And it just shows this, and many adolescents have this bullshit sensor that is so finely tuned. So this human condition, this feeling of being caught in this kind of world. Now, I don't know if I'm just projecting outwards from where I came from as a teenager, but I often feel that Zen students understand this. They know this side. They understand the pain of that place, the difficulty of it, and how nothing else has ever scratched that itch, has ever fixed that problem. All the things we do in the outside world, the things we try to achieve, the things we try to accumulate, have never quite gone there, have never healed that schism. And this is why we're here. This is why we sit so devotedly. Now, I may perhaps be projecting, but I like to believe that that's true, just so perhaps I feel less lonely. So I wanted to read something from the Diamond Sutra that if Holden Caulfield read this, maybe it would have bumped him in a different direction. And incidentally, in the book, and it's kind of despairing, he never quite gets in the right direction. He never quite gets there. No one ever quite brings him there. No one ever quite answers this question for him. We're left hanging. And that is another exquisitely difficult part of this human condition, that we're left hanging. And I should also mention about J.D. Salinger. He was apparently a Zen Buddhist. How fascinating. So, anyway, I'm going to read from the Diamond Sutra. I'm reading to Holden Caulfield. Okay. So Holden here feels so trapped in a self, in a world surrounded by other selves, all of them playing a role, none of them authentic, but not knowing how to get out of this place, and really feeling deeply pained and deeply trapped. And then he finds this book in a bookcase and opens it up to section 3. And the title of it is The Real Teaching of the Great Way. And it goes like this. Buddha said, Sabuti, all the bodhisattva heroes should discipline their thoughts as follows. All living creatures of whatever class, born from eggs, from wombs, from moisture, or by transformation, whether with form or without form, whether in a state of thinking or exempt from thought necessity, or wholly beyond all thought realms, all these are caused by me to attain unbounded liberation, nirvana. Yet, when vast, uncountable, immeasurable numbers of beings have thus been liberated, verily no being has been liberated. Why is this, Subhuti? It is because no bodhisattva, who is a real bodhisattva, cherishes the idea of an ego entity, a personality, a being, or a separated individuality. And that is really one of the cores of Buddhism, and definitely Zen Buddhism, where this is, I would say, our hallmark. Now, he flipped forward a couple of sections to section 5, and these two sections, if you read the Diamond Sutra, if you understand Buddhism, if you do this wonderful practice that is called Zen, that is really not Zen, it's something that can't be named. I would maybe call it the path of intimacy. This is probably the other side of what we're talking about, and the two are two sides of one coin. So Holden read up to section 5, and the title of this is Understanding the Ultimate Principle of Reality. And it goes like this. Subhuti, what do you think? Is the Tathagata to be recognized by some material characteristic? No, world-honored one. The Tathagata cannot be recognized by any material characteristic. Wherefore? Because the Tathagata has said that material characteristics are not, in fact, material characteristics. Buddha said, Subhuti, wheresoever are material characteristics, there is delusion. But whoso perceives that all characteristics are in fact no characteristics, perceives the Tathagata. So, very early in the first few short sections, all the sections of the Diamond Sutra are short, they're very to the point, very pithy, terse, essential. Very early on, the Buddha points to two things. That inside this self that I seem trapped in actually isn't there, isn't a personality, isn't a self. It's only called that. It's just a creation of the thinking mind. When we try to find it, it can't be found. And that's part of our practice, is to go in this direction. So one thing that I will sometimes say is, learning how to do Zazen where you are going to, not the core. Core is not a place. Because then you're still in something. You're still in a separated individuality. You go to the core of the core, the center of the center, the marrow of the marrow. It's not a place, it's a direction. This is going outside this flat land plane in a new direction. It's going in to deep intimacy and continually peeling off the layers deeper and deeper. This is one side of our practice. This is something that had Holden Caulfield been fortunate enough, as we all are, to have met people who have gone in this direction, like Franny and her continual prayer, maybe he would have had a different ending to the book. Who knows? Maybe he will. And the other side of it is that these material characteristics, this solid world we see out here, this world of forms, of entities, and of good and bad, right and wrong, all the so-called opposites, are in fact no characteristics. What does that mean, that they're no characteristics? He said, material characteristics are in fact no characteristics. What does that mean? What does that mean? Remember what the Buddha said about the three marks of existence. He said, everything that seems to be outside, that's the meaning of exist. It means to appear outside yourself, to stand outside yourself. Everything that seems to stand outside, one might as well call these material characteristics, because everything that seems to stand outside has material characteristics. It has color. It has sound. It has feeling. It has thought nature. All of these things are in fact no characteristics. They have three marks. One is dukkha. They are incomplete. They are not complete within themselves. They are not total and perfect within themselves. They're incomplete. And they're impermanent. They're continually changing. These things that we call material characteristics that seem to stand outside, you can't even pin them down. They're changing in each moment. They never stay the same. They're really much more flowing river. They're part of a river. Now, a river has no dividing lines. And that's the third aspect of what the Buddha called the three marks of existence. No self or anatta. No self. What does no self mean? It means that you can't make a dividing line around any of these characteristics to say that that's that characteristic. That's the self of that characteristic. That's the self of that person. You can't find where to draw the line. Everything blends into everything else. Everything is affected by everything else. Everything changes everything else. In fact, everything that seems to be outside is really a single fabric of space-time. They only appear to be characteristics. So the Buddha in the Diamond Sutra will say, these things that you call X, Y, or Z, including Tathagata, is only a figure of speech. There is no real entity like that. It's a figure of speech. Now it's fine. We use figures of speech. We need to communicate. I'm using them tonight. Maps are important. They help us navigate. They help us grasp the world and manipulate it. But we must hold them lightly because they're not real. They exist, but they're not real. Or, as Richard used to put it, they're real, but they don't exist. In other words, they appear to be there. They have an effect, but they actually don't stand outside as entities. So this is the other side of our practice. So I often say, well, what does this mean? How do you use it? I mean, how am I going to bake bread with what you just said, Paul? When we do this practice that we call Zazen, it's a figure of speech, it's not really Zazen, you can't name it. But when we do this profound, intimate practice, we bring this world, so-called world of characteristics, with us. We don't abandon it. We don't leave it behind. We go to this intimate core of the core, this direction, but we bring this world with us. How do we do that? Breath. You stay with this actual breath. And that's that you can't find the dividing line. When you stay with it and go deep into it, you cannot find the separation between you and the breath. You, in this process, are becoming the breath. And you have the trajectory of intimacy with the breath. You do the same with mu or hu, with shikantaza, even with counting. A beginner counting the breath. It's just one. Just two. No meaning. No intention. It's just becoming one in an intimate way. And that is the essence of this practice. This is how we rescue ourselves from having fallen off the cliff. And all of us have fallen off the cliff. There's no one that escapes falling off that cliff. If you don't fall off that cliff, you really have no need for this practice. So you probably wouldn't encounter it to begin with. You wouldn't need it. When I lived in a monastery outside of Los Angeles for a year, I lived in a rather traditional Rinzai setting. Suzaki Roshi, who was the teacher there, said one time, I remember in a Teisho, he said, all of you are sick. He said, this is like an intensive care unit. If you weren't sick, you wouldn't need to be here. That's the way he put it. So, you know, really the first step in this practice is to understand how you've fallen off this cliff, to embrace that, to not lament it, to not criticize yourself for having fallen off the cliff, but to embrace it and then go in the direction that brings you back to this rye field, this intimate place, moment after moment, in your actual experience, no dividing lines. So I'm going to read one other koan here. And this is the first koan from the Hekigan Roku. Now, I'll just mention, as I have before, that there are two classic collections of koan, at least in the Rinzai school of Zen, that are essential in the training of every Zen monk and every Zen student who goes this far. The first collection is the Mumon Kan, and the first koan of the Mumon Kan is the Koan Mu. We all know this koan, we know how profound this koan is, how essential this koan is. Well, the first koan of the Hekigan Roku, which is the next step after the Mumon Kan in our particular school of Zen, which is another 100 koan, these are somewhat more abstruse and perhaps more difficult, but not always. And actually, some of the koan are straight out of the Mumon Kan. But the first koan of the Hekigan Roku I'm going to read to you now. And this koan number one of the Hekigan Roku is titled Bodhidharma's I Don't Know. And I'll read the case. Emperor Wu of Liang asked the great master Bodhidharma, "What is the first principle of the holy teachings?" Bodhidharma said, "Emptiness without holiness." The emperor said, "Who is standing before me?" Bodhidharma replied, "I don't know." Now we could stop there, but I'll read the rest of it. The emperor did not understand. Thereupon Bodhidharma crossed the Yangtze River and came to the kingdom of Wei. Later the emperor brought this up to Prince Qi, who asked, "Does your majesty know who this man is?" The emperor said, "I don't know." Prince Qi said, "He is the Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara," which is the Bodhisattva Kanon, "transmitting the Buddha mind seal." The emperor felt regretful and wanted to send an emissary to invite Bodhidharma to return. Prince Qi told him, "Your majesty, it is no good sending a messenger to fetch him back. Even if everyone in the whole country were to go after him, he still would not return." And that's the koan. So this I don't know. This I don't know. This is, once again, the first koan in the Hekigan Roku. The first koan in these collections often points to the very core of our practice. The core of our practice is not identifying with an entity, is not believing in characteristics. It is really quite the opposite. The fundamental aspect of our practice is I don't know. I don't know. It is the ending of the knowing relationship with the world, the standing apart from it as a knower, as an entity, a self, this self with characteristics, this world outside with characteristics, that this self is caught in, that is trapped in. We go in a different direction. We exit this plane, this flatland plane. We go in a direction that could be called the I don't know direction. Profound not knowing. Going deep into one's actual experience. When one goes so deep into one's actual experience, one is no longer standing apart from it. Therefore, one cannot say one knows it. There's no knowing of it. There's no knower. There's nothing to know. There's just this, just what it is. This is the intimacy, this is the direction that our Zazen must eventually take us. This is what I feel would have made a very big difference for Holden Caulfield and all the Holden Caulfields of the world, including ourselves. So, we're going to end there tonight.